This Week in Palestine offers news from a Palestinian perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees.
You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I am your host, Ann Lucas. Last week, the Jerusalem Fund held their annual conference in Washington, D.C. The Jerusalem Fund works to educate the United States public and policymakers about Palestine's past, present, and future. They also provide community development support to communities in Palestine. This year's conference featured Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, and I really can't think of a more insightful and motivating person to be hearing from at this time. Dr. Barghouti is a medical doctor. He is much better known to the rest of us as Secretary General and co-founder of the Palestinian National Initiative. He has also been a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council since 2006 and is also a member of the Palestinian Central Council. In addition to his political work, he is also the chairman of the Palestinian Medical Relief Society. For Americans, Dr. Barghouti is the explainer-in-chief of all things Palestinian. He is also the defender-in-chief of Palestinians' right to democracy and self-determination. He's been making regular appearances on American TV, doing both of these things, ever since October 7th last year. If you've seen him, you know he's an excellent debater. But for this conference, he was among friends, so no arguing required. Dr. Barghouti's chief inquisitor and the chair of the Q&A was Khaled Al-Gindi. Khaled is with the Middle East Studies Institute, where he serves as a senior fellow and director of the Program on Palestine and Palestinian-Israeli Affairs. He is also the author of the book, Blind Spot: America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump, published in 2019. Most of what we will hear is Dr. Barghouti responding to questions from Khaled, but there will also be a few audience members asking questions on various topics towards the end as well. For radio, I cannot include the entire audience Q&A, so if you want to hear that, you will need to go find our podcast. This Week in Palestine is available as a podcast on all major podcasting platforms. And it often contains additional content that does not fit into the Truth and Justice block on WZBC. The main theme of discussion is democracy and elections, mostly for the Palestinians, but also the American election comes up as well. As you will hear, Dr. Barghouti is advocating for a unity government and snap elections as soon as possible for all Palestinians. An ambitious idea to be sure, that Dr. Barghouti will unpack and interrogate in a variety of ways with Khaled's help. We have a lot to listen to, so yalla bina, let's go.
And for Palestinians, but I can't help also note the elephant in the room, right? The orange elephant in the room. And I want to get your reaction, Doctor, before we delve into the internal Palestinian situation on the U.S. election outcome, which is not just a decisive victory for Donald Trump, but could actually, we're still waiting on the results for the House of Representatives, but it could end up in a complete Republican sweep of both houses of Congress and the White House. So I watched an interview in which you... you indicated that Trump might not allow Netanyahu to get away with the things that that Biden did. I think Netanyahu was quite expert in manipulating President Biden over the last 13 months, especially. But you also warned that under Trump, there's a a much higher risk of both ethnic cleansing in Gaza and annexation in the West Bank. So I wonder if you could just unpack that for us a bit.
Sure, and this is an issue we didn't talk about in the morning, but thank you for asking the question, and thanks. I want to thank everybody for attending today again. I would start, before we talk about Trump's policy, I would like to emphasize the fact that I think one of the contributing factors to the failure of the Democratic Party was the Biden's policy regarding Gaza and the Palestinian people. In my opinion, and I anticipated that actually in so many interviews months before the elections, where I warned that the Democratic Party could lose elections because of their total support and bias to Israel, and their the fact that they were complicit with the genocide that was happening, and even actually participating in the genocide by sending weapons and by even sending American soldiers. So I think what we anticipated has happened. Biden and Kamala Harris lost many places because of their position regarding Gaza, and because they could not exercise any serious pressure on Netanyahu and continued to provide cover to him, even when it was very clear that he was the one who was obstructing ceasefire. That's something Palestinians could not forget, and those who support Palestine could not really give their votes to such an administration. Anyhow, I'm not saying this was the decisive factor, but it was definitely one of the factors. Now with Trump in, I've just been watching something about the policy of Trump regarding Russia and Europe and so on. And one of the respondents said something like, I don't think anybody can absolutely absolutely conclude what Trump will do, because I think Trump up till now doesn't know what he's going to do. And I agree with that, because he's doing his calculations. But there are certain things we cannot forget. He was the one who moved the American embassy to Jerusalem. He was the one who resisted all pressures against such a move that is a violation of international law. He was the one who opened the road for the so-called Abraham's Accords, which was used by Netanyahu and by Israel as a way of liquidating the Palestinian issue through normalization with some Arab countries. He was the one who said before the elections, recent elections, that he noticed that Israel is too small and maybe it needs to be expanded. So all these are, of course, very worrying signs. And we know exactly which camp he comes from. I mean, we know the people around him. We know his vice president. We know their policies. We know how close the evangelical Zionist tendencies are to supporting Israel. So with all of that in mind, we have to be very aware of two risks that we should stand up to and fight against. And the first risk is that the possibility, the potential that he could allow Netanyahu to annex parts or all of the West Bank. That is something that Netanyahu will be working for, especially after the passage of a resolution in the Israeli Knesset against any Palestinian state whatsoever. Will he proceed with the deal of the century that he started before? I don't know, but I want to say that probably Netanyahu would want even that deal anymore, because he doesn't want only parts of the West Bank, he wants all of the West Bank. So the annexation is a very serious matter, and we have to be aware of that. Second is the issue of ethnic cleansing. Netanyahu never gave up his plans of total ethnic cleansing of Gaza. And will Trump and his people push in that direction? That is also another risk. And it's even, in my opinion, a much bigger risk than the issue of annexation. Regardless of these two issues, I don't think any of them will stop us from continuing to struggle for our rights. And anything that is done will not stop us. And that's why I say in conclusion, regardless of who is sitting in the White House, the Palestinian struggle for freedom will continue and will not stop and will not be broken.
Thank you. As you know, President Biden still has another 2.5 months left in his term. And what do you see as happening in the immediate term? Does Biden have more or less leverage now with Netanyahu than he did before the election?
I don't expect anything. I think Biden has been weak even before being a leaving president. And as you know, I mean, he is not in a position now to decide on major policy issues. And I don't think he wants to do anything anyhow, because the man has proven to be totally biased to Israel, to be a Zionist, as he described himself. And his legacy will be, somebody was talking to Biden about his legacy. I think in this new book of Bob Woodward, he describes a conversation between Blinken and Biden, where Biden was asking Blinken whether he should abstain from running for president. And Blinken responded to him, "The most important thing for you now is your legacy, and your legacy will be one line. And if you fail in the elections, that will be your line." Well, in my opinion, his line, the legacy of Biden, will be forever that he allowed genocide to happen in Gaza. And I do not expect anything from this man.
Thank you. So President Abbas, like most world leaders, has congratulated Donald Trump on his election victory. But I was struck by the language that he used in his letter of congratulations, and I'm just going to quote this piece here. He says, "We remain unwavering in our commitment to peace and are confident that under your leadership, the United States will support the legitimate aspirations of the Palestinian people." What do you make of this statement by President Abbas? Is this just a diplomatic nicety, or do you think he genuinely believes that there is some opportunity in a Trump administration?
Well, diplomatically, he has to say positive things. That's something I can't blame him for. But the question is whether he believes what he wrote or not. If he wrote it for diplomatic reasons, that's fine. If he believes in it, then I think that's wishful thinking. And the main problem with the Palestinian Authority, and this is something I have always said, and it's not new, is that they have built their policy on the basis of two illusions. And the first illusion was that the Zionist movement and the Israeli establishment is ready for a compromise. That was the justification for the so-called Oslo Agreement. And that was the philosophy behind the whole talk about two-state solution. What we've seen, not only in the course of this terrible genocide in Gaza and the terrible attacks that are happening and settlement expansion in the West Bank, but even before that, what we've seen from the behavior of Netanyahu and the Israeli society that supports him is that there is no place for a compromise for these people. And Netanyahu himself was the one who undermined Oslo Agreement. He was the one who aggravated the Israeli public against Yitzhak Rabin until he was assassinated. He was the one who blocked any negotiations since 2014. You're talking about 10 years of nothing. So, and continuous expansion of settlements and continuous erosion of any possibility or potential for a Palestinian state. And then finally, a resolution in the Israeli Knesset supported by both the government parties and opposition Zionist parties against any Palestinian state. So the first illusion has been proven to be an illusion. The Zionist movement does not want a compromise with Palestinians. We have to understand that. And we have to build our struggle and our strategy on that understanding. The second illusion, which prevailed since Oslo Agreement and before, maybe since the 80s, when the PLO gave up its original slogan or original goal of one democratic state in all of Palestine, the second illusion was that the United States can be a mediator between Palestinians and Israelis. Well, that was an illusion too. What we have seen during the course of the last years, but particularly during this attack on Gaza, is that the United States is not a mediator, cannot be a mediator. The United States is on the side of Israel. I mean the United States administration, of course, and not the United States people.
Thank you. What does the Trump's re-election mean for efforts to put the Palestinian House in order? And just to help kind of frame the issue a little bit or put it in perspective, immediately after the Abraham Accords in September 2020, we saw an effort by Palestinian factions, probably the most serious effort we'd seen up until that point, to move toward reconciliation. And then there was a schedule put together for elections. And then we all know the story, how elections were canceled at the last minute. But it seemed like the existential threat that was posed by the Abraham Accords kind of forced Palestinians to overcome their petty differences and move them. In contrast, when we see an actual genocide taking place, a genuine existential threat, we don't see real movement. I mean, of course, we saw the meeting in Beijing, but I think President Abbas almost immediately kind of dismissed the result of that meeting. So does this now, does not just what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank, but also the election of Donald Trump and the likelihood that things could get even worse for Palestinians, does this now force Palestinians into a place where they have to put their house in order? And what does that look like?
It should. And that's what I said in the morning. I said in the morning that the one of the main important pillars of our struggle and our strategy is to create a unified Palestinian leadership. Because you cannot really win any fight or any struggle without really a unified leadership, and especially under the conditions that we have to struggle for. And in that sense, I think, unfortunately, the 2021 elections were canceled, and there is no justification for that cancellation. And to clarify, I mean that we met in Cairo, all the Palestinian groups. We agreed to have elections. We agreed to have a fully proportional system, which meant no single party would probably get an absolute majority. We also agreed to postpone the presidential elections because that's what Fatah asked for and the president asked for, although the law says that they should happen together, presidential and parliamentary elections. But nevertheless, to move forward, we said, okay, let's do the parliamentary elections. And then, of course, Israel did not give its permission to have elections in Jerusalem. And we said then in Cairo and in our meetings that we should not allow Israel to have the veto power over our elections. And that means we can run elections without Israeli permission in Jerusalem. We could have spread 150 boxes all over the city and with 20 cameras with each box and then make it the best form of nonviolent resistance, civil disobedience against Israeli measures. I think if we did it, we would have had much more people voting than under normal circumstances. But unfortunately, the authority decided to cancel elections. And I think they were worried about results of elections because they could not have a unified list for their camp. But that's history. Why I mention that? Because had we have elections in 2021, there is every possibility, probably 99%, we would not have had this war. And we would have had a different way of removing the siege on Gaza and having a unified government and a unified leadership. But that didn't happen. Now, today, knowing the risks that we have, including the terrible massacre in Gaza and the massacres also in the West Bank, we went to Moscow first and we had a meeting in which we agreed that we should have some sort of unified government. And then in Beijing, we reached an agreement, which I personally drafted, by the way. And that agreement spoke about three issues: forming a national consensus government, and calling the interim Palestinian leadership for a meeting, which was decided before in other meetings, and then calling a meeting of all Palestinian leaders and put a time frame for unification of Palestinians. All the groups signed this agreement, including Fatah. The deputy head of Fatah, Mr. Alul, signed the agreement. Hamas signed the agreement. We all signed the agreement. But unfortunately, as you said, it was never implemented. And even there wasn't a single move towards really forming a national consensus government. Now, under Trump, I think the risks are higher. And that's where I think we should move in that direction. And I do not like the idea of forming some sort of an administrative structure for Gaza. The best thing is to form a national consensus government to prevent separating Gaza from West Bank, which the Israelis will try to do, and to prevent the establishment of some sort of collaborating structure in Gaza under Israeli occupation. So the need for unity is much bigger and larger than any time before, but it's not any unity. In my opinion, for a true unity to be, it has to be about a program, a strategy that is clear, a strategy that concentrates on a joint struggle of all Palestinian groups and forces and people towards a very clear goal of our freedom. And a unity that does not, that departs from what we described as two illusions. I think that's the kind of unity that would work and would survive and would be productive actually for the Palestinian people. But I think things will not change on their own. That's why while we talk with other groups, we are also working now at the grassroots level. There is one initiative of calling for a national Palestinian Congress to demand a unified Palestinian leadership. I mean, what we need now is not to wait for some other meetings that will never produce anything, but to exercise pressure on the political Palestinian forces to achieve a Palestinian national unified leadership. And that means grassroots pressure from the ground. I believe that the public has the right to do so. And this is not about substituting PLO or harming CRPLO. It's about reactivating PLO, which has been totally marginalized within the Palestinian Authority that is restricted so much by Israeli occupation.
Thank you for that. So it sounds like what you're saying is that or maybe I should pose it as a question. What or who is the primary obstacle to this national consensus government actually being put together with this broader national vision? And if it's Fatah, or Abu Mazen in particular, what does a national congress mean if it doesn't include Fatah? If in fact Fatah is the obstacle?
I don't think Fatah is the obstacle.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, a very huge number of the people who are with us in this initiative of Congress are from Fatah. A big number of them, and many of them are leaders. Some of them are members of the Revolutionary Council of Fatah. So We are talking about leaders in Fatah who agree with what I am saying to you, that we need a unified leadership and we need it quickly.
So then what is the obstacle?
Well, in my opinion, I don't want to use the word obstacle, but I, to be diplomatic, if you allow me, but I want to say that the picture is clear. We had an agreement about a national consensus government. The president is the one who should initiate the process of consultation with different political parties in Palestine to form the national consensus government. He did not yet. And 2 months have passed, more than 2 months, actually. And what is needed is that the president should initiate these discussions and as soon as possible. Instead of proceeding with that, we've seen Fatah and Hamas meeting in Cairo and discussing something else, which is an administrative committee, sort of, as they claimed. We told them, frankly, that we don't think this is the right idea because this includes in it certain risks. Hamas said that they prefer national consensus government, but if that's what they can, what can happen, they will also accept it. In my opinion, the right approach is really to insist on national consensus government. And in this order, we need national consensus government, we need unified interim leadership, and we need, as soon as it will be possible, after we stop this terrible aggression and war on our people in Gaza, we need free democratic elections. We need elections that include both Palestinians in the occupied territories and Palestinians outside occupied territories. I mean by that, we need elections for the parliament, which should become part of the Palestinian National Council. But you, the Palestinians in the United States, should be able to choose freely and democratically whoever you want to represent you in the Palestinian new National Council. That's how we can reactivate the PLO, and that's how we can reactivate a unified Palestinian front, which is effective, which can be productive. So talking about national consensus government temporarily does not negate the main goal, the main thing we've been asking for and demanding for years, which is the right of the Palestinian people to freely and democratically choose their leaders.
Where does the PLO fit into this equation? You talked about the consensus government as a first step and a broader, and then there's a kind of interim council of some sort. What is the relationship of both of those to the PLO? And is the PLO, is that now reforming and restructuring the PLO? Is that now basically delayed to some point in the future?
On the contrary, it is about reforming the PLO because now the PLO does not include all the Palestinian groups. The formula we are talking about will ensure that everybody is in the leadership, that there is no people inside and people outside. Because at this moment, to be frank with you, what we have is the following. We have Hamas and Jihad outside the PLO. We have three or four groups who are in the PLO but are not participating in the meetings of the PLO. I mean by that some groups that are in Syria and so on. And then you have people in the PLO, like Palestinian National Initiative and PFLP, for instance, who are excluded from the leadership of the PLO. So they act, we act as opposition inside the PLO, but we are in the PLO. Yet we are excluded from the decision-making process. When we speak about interim leadership, what we mean by that is that that structure that was agreed upon by Palestinian political groups before includes all representatives of all parties, including Hamas and Jihad, everybody, and the executive committee of the PLO. So this way, you not only preserve the PLO, but also expand it to include everybody. But that's only the first step, because eventually we should have elections for the Palestinian National Council. I insist, that's the right way to reform the PLO. without elections, without democratic elections, it becomes just an issue of dividing the cake between the groups, and that's not the right way.
So why not start with the PLO instead of a bottom-up approach with this consensus government first? Why not start with a reformed PLO that brings in all of the groups outside the PLO into the PLO, at least the executive committee, and then from there use that as a basis for making decisions, consensus-based decisions for a consensus government or the day after in Gaza or whoever will manage the day-to-day affairs? But wouldn't it make sense to establish a credible and legitimate leadership at the top first, and then everything flows from that?
But that's exactly what I am saying. The formation of national consensus government should go in parallel with what I've just described, the formation of a unified leadership, which is exactly what you have said now. So it's not two separate processes. Sorry?
They happen simultaneously?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
That's what we agreed about. Yeah.
Okay. In terms of elections, how feasible is it to hold elections, particularly given the mass destruction in Gaza? How long, I mean, what, you know, when would elections become feasible in a place like Gaza, and assuming that it's not possible to hold elections everywhere but Gaza? And I guess that's my first question. And then depending on that, I have a follow-up question.
Well, I believe, of course, we have the first important goal for any Palestinian now is to stop this terrible genocide in Gaza. There is nothing more important than that. The suffering of our people in Gaza now is beyond description. I've described in the morning what types of suffering people have, and I will not repeat that now, but I think all of you understand it and know it, and you see it on TV. The situation is horrible. And so there is nothing more important now than stopping that terrible genocide. And that's where our efforts should be. But I do not think that it should take very long time between ending this terrible aggression and ending the genocide and having elections. I don't know, maybe a year, maybe a little bit less. But you have to understand that regardless of all this terrible destruction, the public of Palestine, the people of Palestine are so much thirsty for exercising their right of choosing their leaders. There will be lots of differences between us once this war is over. There will be different opinions. There will be different suggestions about who was responsible for what. You can see that in the debates that are taking place now. So how do you solve all of that? The best way is to allow the people to practice democratically their elections and then choose the right line that they believe in. And I still believe that even after elections, we will not have a situation where one single party will have an absolute majority. And so we will not have this terrible system of that we suffered from for a very long time, which is one party rule. It doesn't work. The Palestinian people have differences. The Palestinian people have pluralism, and this has to be reflected in a unified leadership. And one more thing. People have been used to having a single leader, one leader. Didn't work. What we need is really collective leadership. And that can happen with a unified leadership. And we have to respect each other. We have to accept each other. And we have to learn how to create a common platform that we all agree about, given the fact that the platform should serve the interest of the Palestinian people before it serves the interest of certain leaders. That's the way I look at things. And that's, I think, how we can salvage our future as Palestinian people.
On the question of elections, I think almost everyone supports the idea of free and fair elections, and of course, giving people the right to choose their own leaders and representatives. But I wonder, elections are a thermometer reading at a particular moment in time. And so I wonder if it's a good idea to hold elections, I mean, even a year or two after the end of this genocide, the suffering in Gaza will continue. There will still be massive trauma and psychological effects, in addition to long-term health effects. There are no institutions left in Gaza. It will take many, many years to rebuild. So the suffering won't end anytime soon. So I wonder, is it smart to hold elections in an environment of such enormous collective pain and trauma? We look at our own experiences in this country. When we get slightly higher inflation, it can radically alter the direction of an election. And so I'm just trying to imagine what holding an election in Gaza would look like even in 2 or 3 years.
Let me remind you, when did we have elections as Palestinians last time? 2006. We are now in 2024. Can you believe that all this time we did not have free democratic elections? A whole generation of younger people has never voted in their life for who should be their leaders. Let me ask you another question. Do you know when we had the last elections of Gaza municipality? I think I will shock everybody now when I give you the answer. The last elections of the Gaza municipality happened in 1946, even before the Nakba. Why is that? Because when we had municipality elections, the people in charge preferred to delay the elections in Gaza because they were expecting results that will not serve them. And the outcome was no elections. No, I don't agree. When Britain had the war, immediately after the war, they had elections. That's the way you give people the power. You empower people to decide. If we don't empower our people to make decisions by themselves, other countries will decide for us. Look, they are standing in line. Some countries in the region want to decide for us who should be governing Gaza. Some others want to go deep in normalization with Israel. And now they are happy that Trump was reelected. And they don't care about the future of Palestinians. The biggest risk at us Palestinians now, I want everybody to understand that, the biggest risk besides the terrible damage that was caused to us by this terrible genocide is to take away from us, the Palestinians, our right of self-representation. PLO was praised by the Palestinian people and respected because it represented our right of self-representation. And when we lost any form of democratic internal processes, there was a decline of the PLO and it became vulnerable to external pressures. So some other country in the region want to impose a person that works for them as a leader of Palestinians. Another group wants to impose on us some kind of experts that come from the World Bank, etc., etc., etc. We need the people to decide. If we respect the suffering of the people of Gaza and respect the suffering of the people of West Bank and respect also the need of our Palestinians everywhere, we have to give them the right to choose. And we already formed a formula to elect a Palestinian National Council that would consist of 350 members, 150 members from the occupied territories and 200 from outside. And somebody will say, but in this country, we will not be able to run elections. Okay, we do it everywhere we can. And then we find a solution for the places we couldn't have elections in. But I don't think denying the right of the people to choose and elect will help us. Continuing this situation where you don't have a democratic choice, I am not against interim arrangements. We agreed about that. That's why we speak about national consensus government, interim leadership, etc. But eventually, The Palestinian people have the right to choose their leaders. The younger generation among Palestinians have the right to also be part of the leadership. They have the right to choose their leaders as well. None of them have ever voted. And that is a problem.
Okay, so I think now we're going to move into the audience Q&A phase. I don't know how we want to do this. Are do people lining up, or am I just calling on people? Okay, the gentleman here in the back.
Thank you, Khaled. Thank you, Dr. Mustafa. My name is Saeed Araqat. I'm a Palestinian journalist. I want to ask...
Saeed, يعني you are so well known. And by the way, listen, what you are doing in the press conferences is amazing. I mean, please keep it up.
I wanted to ask you, you know, and I know it is a controversial question, about the viability of holding elections under occupation. You know, the occupation basically controlled the life of every Palestinian man, woman, and child. You know, you talked about 700 checkpoints that pepper the West Bank. You talk about Gaza that is under annihilation, actual annihilation, and so on. And I want to see, what is the viability of the election? How could it be conducted? And how are you going to include Palestinians in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan? How would they be included? What is the mechanism for doing that? I don't say this to be controversial. I honestly want to learn, because you have been doing this process for a very long time. Thank you.
Well, you remember, we did have elections in 2005 and 2006, but and 1996, by the way. And although we were under occupation. And in 2005, Israel tried to impose new conditions, but without declaring them. And the conditions were that you could run, but you can't campaign in Jerusalem. And I violated that. As you remember, I was running for president at the time, and I didn't care about what they are doing. And I went to Jerusalem, and they arrested me one time. And then I went again, and they arrested me for the second time, four times in 1 month. And each time they did the arrest, it made me even more determined to go back. In my opinion, what the occupation decides is not necessarily what we should accept. What I'm trying to say is that we have to defy the other side. Now, of course, if Israel wants to prevent elections, they can prevent elections totally. They can impose curfew on the whole of the occupied territories, for sure. But we have to decide together what democratic form we should use to make sure that our leadership is accepted by the people. And their decisions are accepted by the people. You know me, and you know very well how much the Palestinian leadership now is criticized. What's the solution to that? The only solution is to have some sort of democratic process. Now, you are right about asking the question. I don't think it would be difficult for Palestinians to choose their representatives in Chile or United States or Europe or even in Lebanon. I don't think that is problematic. It can be done. Maybe the biggest problem would be in Jordan because of the nature of the fact that they are Jordanian citizens. That's an issue that needs to be discussed. But in general, I think if we have the will, we can find the way. The principle has to be accepted first, which is that the people have the right to choose their leaders. We can have interim structures for a while, through consensus and agreements between different Palestinian groups. But you know, for instance, not all Palestinians are part of the Palestinian political parties. There are actually the majority are independents. How do you represent them? How do you make sure that they are also represented in the decision-making process? I think the most important issue for us now as Palestinians is what kind of forum we can create. Maybe if we can't have elections immediately, we can find some other forms. But the main issue is to have structures that can allow the utmost possible representation of people's opinion in the decision-making process.
Abdelhamid.
Thank you, Dr. Mustafa. Abdul Hamid Asiyan.
أهلين أخ عبد الحميد، يعطيك العافية.
How are you?
Fine, fine.
Okay. There is a misconception that national unity means meeting of 14 factions, signing a declaration, and going back, and that's national unity. And it has been proven again and again it's wrong. They met in Beijing, they met in Moscow, they met in Algiers, in the city of Alamein, in Mecca, in Doha, and national unity had not been established. Now there is some group of intellectuals, Palestinians, writers, doctors, activists, you are one of them, thinking
and you are one of them.
And I am. Yes. Thinking outside the box and trying to find some other options, what we call the National Conference on Palestine, trying to rebuild the PLO, trying to revitalize the PLO, trying to make real national unity within the PLO, not a new leadership, not a new structure, but to revitalize this almost dead entity, which is called the PLO. So where we are from that initiative and where we are going, how can you describe it to the audience? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we both participated in the most recent meeting about preparing for such a Congress. And I think now we have agreed on the most important thing, that we agreed about the principles of such a movement. And as you said, and I said that before you said it, which is that not all Palestinians are in these factions. Actually, if you look at polls carefully, and I don't want to hurt the feelings of anybody, but actually out of the 14, probably only 5 or 6 will record in public polls, which is another indication that the people's opinion is so important. I think the Congress could be, we jointly approved a list of principles, the 9 principles about the nature of this Congress. And the first of which, it says that we are not intending to substitute the PLO or replace the PLO or create an alternative to the PLO, but to strengthen and reactivate the PLO and reform the PLO, so that it can regain its duty as a leader of the Palestinian national liberation struggle. And second, I think it was clear that we agreed that what we are talking about is not a new party or even a new organization. We are talking about a new movement, if I might say so, as we called it in Arabic, Hirak, a movement towards the reform and towards the creation. And that is the most important issue, the creation of a unified Palestinian leadership. So I would say that in summary, what we are talking here about is about a lobby, a pressure grassroots group that is going to expand to include Palestinians from everywhere. I think the people who participated in the last meeting came from 60 different countries. And I think that is a good platform to unify all Palestinian ideas and to create a movement that is a pressure group to create a Palestinian unified leadership. I think it's a good move. I hope it succeeds. And we should do everything we can to make it succeed without anybody having to change their opinion. We're not creating a new party or one unified political program. We are creating a specific movement, a lobby movement, if I might call it so, to pressure for all Palestinian political groups to create a unified leadership.
The gentleman in the green.
I did want your opinion on the making the Nakba, which has been continuing since 1948 into a war crime. But I also wanted your views on two matters that are not covered as much in the American press, which is all of the prisoners, many of whom are just preventative detention prisoners, political prisoners that have not been released by Israel. And I presume that is one of the reasons why the ceasefire didn't take place, and the horrendous destruction now within the West Bank.
Yes, well, unfortunately, we speak about the first Nakba, and now we are witnessing the second Nakba, because what's happening in Gaza is worse even than the Nakba that maybe happened in 1948 in terms of the number of human losses and so on. Regarding the prisoners, since 7th of October, Israel arrested 11,600 Palestinians in the West Bank, new prisoners, among them 850 children. Many of them are kept under the so-called administrative detention, which means people are put in jail without knowing why, without charges, without their lawyers even knowing why they are arrested. No country does that. I mean, it's except Israel in this manner. And in addition to that, there are at least 5,000 or 6,000 Israeli prisoners in Gaza, many of whom were kidnapped, and some of whom, as I mentioned in the morning, were unfortunately field executed. What hurts me really is that is in the foreign media is that they frequently speak about the 103 Israeli prisoners or captives, if you want. And they never mention a word about the 16,000 Palestinian prisoners. And I don't want any of the Israeli prisoners to stay in prison. I mean, they can go home, but also the 16,000 Palestinian prisoners have to also be released. And I know I am realistic. I know that a deal will not include the 16,000 people, but at least some of those who have been in jail for so many years. A relative of mine by the name of Nael Barghouti has been in Israeli jails already for 43 years. Another one is sentenced to 67 life imprisonments, which is about 5,400 years. I mean, imagine. So one of the main things that I have a problem with many Western media outlets is that they don't talk about us as equal human beings. If a Jewish life is precious, a Palestinian life is also precious. If a Jewish girl should not be killed, a Palestinian child also should not be killed. I think everything starts from this point. Are we accepted as equal human beings or not? Whether you talk about children or you talk about prisoners or you talk about human beings in general. And that's, in my opinion, a starting point that we should all keep in mind. Because if you solve this issue that we are equal human beings, then so much of the discrimination that is used against Palestinian people will disappear.
Last question.
Okay. All right. Diane Perlman. I'm a political psychologist in the field of conflict transformation with Transcend International. So you said you're allergic. So people are, I'd say the one-two-state solution, there are more than two options, and I think they're simplistic, and I think they're radioactive. So there's like hysteria on both sides, and there are different kinds of arrangements. But in the field of conflict transformation, as opposed to resolution, is you create a new reality, and rather than just compromise. And one of the things I heard Gershom Baskin say is, you know, first we have to stop the violence, of course, and then we need new leadership on both sides, and then we'll figure out. And there are also Johan Gautung, who I brought to speak here in this room in 2017, had an idea of a six-state solution modeled after the European Community. And there's a land for all. There are different creative possibilities, but I think first we have to go through de-traumatization and justice and truth. I think psychologically, it would be helpful to have new forms of leadership, a new leadership. And I don't mean like individual wise people who can't be there, but that aren't associated with the form. It'll be hard to heal. So what do you think about the idea of like new leadership, new forms, new identity, new images that are creating a new reality rather than continuation of the same?
Well, we need new thinking for sure. It's not up to me to decide who should be the leaders of Israel, and it's not up to Israel to decide who should be our leaders. I think that has to be the decision of the people. But the problem we face in the case of Israel now is that, unfortunately, the majority of the Israeli public, especially after the 7th of October, turned into severe extremism and racism. And that's what feeds fascism that is growing in Israel. And I think there has to be a lot of rehabilitation work to diffuse this kind of extreme thinking. On the Palestinian people side, of course, we have pain, a lot of pain. Maybe we will not today decide what kind of form we should use, but I think the starting point, and I'd like to repeat that, the starting point of any solution is to accept each other as equal human beings. That is a principle. If we don't accept each other as equal human beings, we will not be able to find any form of a solution. And of course, accepting each other as equal human beings means accepting the principle of justice. And that means accepting the rights of Palestinian people. Not to tell Palestinians that only Jewish people have the right for self-determination in this country. So I believe everything starts with these two words, accepting each other as equal human beings and accepting justice as a principle. Without justice, there will be no peace. So many efforts were made before and so many agreements were concluded without adhering to the principle of justice. And the result was one round of fight after the other. Only the principle of justice is the one that would allow us to reach a true, durable peace in the region.
Thank you. I think that's a very powerful point to end on. Thank you, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, and thank you to our audience.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mustafa. You have an open invitation here anytime you have a chance. And thank you all for staying. Thank you, Dr. Jindi, by the way. I say, by the power vested in me, by me, I hereby declare you a doctor. With that, 15-minute coffee break.
Bye.